It is only when we find it impossible to reconcile the spurious knowledge of such an illusion with the content of normal experience that doubt begins to awaken within us and we are led to discover that it is illusory. So long as we remain content with the knowledge we have, we accept first impressions about things or people for what they seem to be, but when they come into direct conflict with other facts which emerge in the course of subsequent experience, the question of their criterion of validity arises. Then the need of putting them to the test and where necessary correcting them is felt. If our illusion is to be recognized as such, then the evidence of the senses is to be denied, whilst if the evidence of the senses is to be accepted, then we have two coexistent realities claiming to be one and the same thing. This absurd situation means that we are not to trust entirely to what our senses tell us about a thing's reality, although we may trust them to tell us about a thing's existence. It means also that to call anything real is a dubious and dangerous procedure. What becomes of everyday experience of matter, for instance, when it is contradicted by pure reason? Therefore, to appear is one thing, whereas to be is another. We must learn to take care to distinguish between the two concepts. The puzzling contradictions of illusion vanish when we understand that different standpoints produce different perceptions, that from the standpoint of reflective reason we may possibly perceive a thing differently than from the standpoint of sense experience, and that it is a primitive attitude to take such experience as always possessed of decisive sanction. The existence of an illusion like the brigand seen in the bush cannot be denied. It would be absurd to reject anyone's experience of it, for to deny an illusion is to deny the content of experience and to negate what is given in consciousness. All that we may rightly do is to reject a particular interpretation of it, that is to say, to reject its reality. It exists but it is not real. We have in fact to distinguish between the various kinds of existence, for we now see that something can exist and be real whilst another thing can exist and yet be unreal. Here again the need of penetrating behind the facade of a word becomes plain. In an earlier chapter it was shown that the term fact was open to unsuspected interpretations, and so here analysis of the two terms exist and real proves useful, although everybody who has never reflected about the matter wrongly assumes he already knows this meaning. These words mislead most people because they think that whatever appears to them or whatever looks like reality must necessarily be real. Their error is to be satisfied that merely because they perceive things the latter are therefore real things. Perception is no proof of reality. For we may have wrong perception and imaginary perception even among the so-called real perceptions. Men in delirium may see blue snakes and nobody dare deny that they are perceived. Such snakes must therefore be said to exist, for they do exist in the mind of the sufferers, to whom they are unquestionably real. Similarly, nobody can deny that objective things exist, for they are perceived by the minds of men, who also regard them as unquestionably real, but in both these cases the philosopher is entitled to question not their existence but their reality. Everybody can see and nobody can dispute that there is a brick wall confronting us, for instance. When it is said, however, that this wall can have only a mental existence, it is totally unjust, totally false and totally stupid to misrepresent this assertion as meaning that the wall has no existence whatever. And when we say that we are touching this wall, we do not mean that we are touching the shadow of a real wall called an idea, but that the touch itself is an idea and that the various mental sensations of the wall is all of the wall we shall ever know, not that it is a copy of the real material wall, which appears to be somewhere beyond our body. It is preposterous and unintelligent to misconstrue the results of this analysis into a statement that a wall which is plainly beheld is but a shadow of the real wall and that the chair in which we now sit is but a mere copy of the real chair, which exists somewhere else in space. Both chair and wall do in point of fact exist quite as much for the mentalist philosopher as for the materialist, the difference being that the former by a profound and habitual reflection has pierced into the true nature of their existence. He has certainly never denied them away. And if such a philosopher thinks that the chair in which he sits and the pen with which he writes do not really exist, he will not go to the trouble of writing any book. And to those who would object that a mental reality is equivalent to no reality at all, He would reply that there is no other that we human beings know. The downfall of materialism. The word real has a meaning only when it is distinguished from the word unreal, in the same way that one color can only be distinguished by its contrast with another. Therefore, no adequate definition of reality CSM be found until the proper meaning of its contrary is also found. Now people often make the mistake of thinking that because a thing is unreal it should therefore be invisible. Illusions prove the contrary. The world will be visible both to the philosopher and to the ignorant man, but whereas the latter will deem it to be just as he sees it, the former will deem it physically unreal but mentally constructed. Objects are seen physically and externally but cannot exist apart from the mind's construction of them. We are not asked to doubt the actual appearance of the things we see nor give up our belief in their existence. We are asked to ascertain the kind of their existence, whether it be illusory or real, and we are asked to distinguish the pretended reality of what is merely an idea from the genuine reality of what unchangingly is, a point into which we shall shortly inquire. There is vital difference between the terms unreal and non-existent. Let us not leap hastily past these words. We need to be most careful when we denounce anything as such. We may rightly speak of a barren woman's son as being non-existent. We may not, however, label the brigand seen in the bush as equally non-existent but only as unreal. For he acquires existence, although not reality, by the mere act of being perceived. The two categories are totally different in meaning from each other and ought not to be confused. Non-existent things must be carefully distinguished from existent ones when we class both as illusions. A unicorn and a round square belong to the first class because you cannot even think them or imagine them. They are hollow, meaningless phrases, whereas a mirage seen in the desert belongs to the second because it is a discredited appearance. The former can never be observed under any conditions, but the latter may be seen under certain conditions. It is important that we take care, therefore, not to confuse absolute mental existence with absolute non-existence. Everything which we see and touch really does exist. There is and there cannot be the slightest doubt of that, but it may not exist in the way in which we believe. It may exist mentally whilst not existing physically. It is now needful to inquire still more closely what we mean when we use this word real. Are we able to form any picture in our mind to correspond with it? If we are, there is the bewildering situation that other people may and will form a different picture, giving it a different definition. The notion which postulates the real as what can be weighed and measured, and which implies that all mental things are a kind of luminous haze floating above the real physical world and unable to affect it at all, is, as has been earlier shown in our study of matter, bad science and worse philosophy. We must protest against it. What then are the tests and characteristics of reality? To reply with most that experience of the external world of things is alone real, or to assert with a few that experience of the internal world of thoughts is alone real, is to ignore that such a view is based on the feeling of reality and to forget that we have a similar feeling during dream which both these views may denounce as unreal. Hence it is useless to judge by feeling. We must first find a definition that will hold always. Few people care to define so scrupulously. They want to judge by feeling or by temperament alone. The consequence is that they imagine reality, they study their own idea of it only, and thus lamentably fail to avoid deceiving themselves into accepting what merely pleases them, not what is true. At one time science said that the reality behind the world was made of atoms, later it said that the real stuff was made of molecules, still later it said things were really electrons. Now it is beginning to stutter something else. Science now confesses that there is no guarantee that it has reached the last secret of the supposed world is tough. Should it therefore not drop the word real from its vocabulary, and should we also not drop it, altogether? For both science and we are dealing only with what appears to us, with what is presented to us, but not with what is ultimately hidden beneath all these presentations of atoms, molecules, electrons and whatnot. Having burnt its fingers, however, science has learned to keep itself fluid to its conception of reality. Therefore it has now learnt never to put forward a final statement about this elusive word. Thus the path of human knowledge is a progressive awakening from illusory things which exist but which are ultimately unreal. The fact finally known for what it is the reality, whereas the final knowledge of the thing is the truth. This is correct only from the standpoint of practical affairs and until we reach the ultimate. Then there are no two things, but unity, and hence no distinction between truth and reality. European metaphysicians have evolved a plausible doctrine which multiplies the degrees of reality. They would have come nearer to truth had they said that there exist degrees of the apprehension of reality. In that unity, the downfall of materialism, which is the unchangeably real, there can never be any gradation whatsoever. F.P.R., as the ancient Indian philosophers, not mystics, have rightly said, that is real which can not only give us certainty about its existence in its own right beyond all possibility of doubt and independently of man's individual ideation, but which can remain changeless amid the flux of an ever-changing world. Such a reality is, after the pursuit of ultimate truth, the foremost pursuit of philosophy, whether it be labeled God, Spirit, Absolute or otherwise. What has become of the millions of human beings who have died? What has become of the prehistoric palaces of unrecorded kings? What has become of those kings themselves? All have crumbled away into dust and vanished. But what has become of that which appeared in the forms of those men and buildings? Whoever took it to be matter did not even know he was dealing with mind. Our own inquiry into it must take us not only through the appearances of matter but also beyond the workings of mind. This is the inquiry into ultimate permanent reality. This is philosophy. When it shall be our good fortune to come into the fuller understanding of such a reality, we shall find, as the old sage is found, that this puzzling world does not stand in startling contradiction to it as we fear. For in a subtler sense which we do not grasp but present, the one is no less real than the other. The world is not essentially an illusion. Ultimately it is as real as the world of this unnameable uniqueness that is the true God. Things therefore are not themselves illusory, but it is our apprehension of them, as furnished by the senses, which is illusory. Nobody need worry over the loss of matter. It is something which we have never possessed, and consequently the loss is not a real one. The world which has been revealed by our thoughts is the only world we have known, although it is not the ultimate world that we shall know. Therefore the truth robs us of nothing. He who flees the world in ascetic disdain flees from reality. He should correct himself first and thus learn to understand aright what is that something which appears as the world. What it is, what that ultimate reality means to the life of man, is the second quest of philosophy after the quest of truth, because we soon find that both quests are involved in one another. And this is therefore the second reward which philosophy holds out to man, that he shall learn how to live consciously in reality rather than blindly in illusion. The world is a thought. We have been dealing with the cases of single objects and isolated things and found them to be ultimately ideas. But we have to remember that these fragmentary facts which, acts ideas appear continuously in our daily life. It is therefore now necessary to take them up into a unity, to connect them together into the world process and thus relate them to the world in which we are living. We have discovered every inanimate thing and every living creature to be a mental construct. Now the whole world is only an assemblage of all things and all creatures in their totality. Have we then the courage to take the intellectual plunge, to be bold enough and march straight to the logical conclusion that the whole world is itself but an idea also? The world is a world of relatives, a network of connected colors, sounds, spaces, times and there. Dependent things, all things exist in relation to other things, but relations themselves are ultimately ideas. The limitless panorama of the passing world is a mental one. Such is the tremendous thought with which we are faced, that age-old solar systems rolling through space are as much mental constructs as the pen which we analyzed, down to the point of regarding it as a pure percept. The universe in all its immensity consists in the end of a construct of mind. This is the psychological picture of our external world. It is a gigantic mental construct and nothing more. For perceptual experience stretches its embrace over everything and nothing known to man can stand outside it. Mentalism alone provides an adequate explanation. It expounds the manner in which mind creates its own space to contain all the objects which it equally constructs from itself. Space is as much an idea as the things that seem to stand in it. If, as relativity has begun to show, space-time is the continuum of the world of material objects, then whatever this mysterious fourth dimension may be, it can only be something that is within mind and therefore ultimately mental itself. Thus, although we begin by contemplating the universe as being presented to mind, we end by contemplating it as constructed by mind. That a world exists around and outside our bodies is a certainty and not a deception. That this world exists around and outside our mind is a deception and not a certainty. For there is no such thing as existence outside or inside the mind. Ideas may be outside or inside each other, but all stand in non-spatial relation to mind. There is no such thing as an extramental world of objects. Yet men are everywhere convinced of its existence. The human body is a part of the world. The world is an idea and the body must be an idea with it. If the world stands outside body, it does not stand outside mind, but must fall within it. If the world existed outside the mind that perceives it, it could never be perceived at all, for the mind does not get beyond its own states, that is ideas. The downfall of materialism, the part played by the five sense instruments, is therefore to provide the conditions whereby man participates in the perception of objects as external to the body. The senses are the means whereby he shares the ideas of a material world which subsist in the dimensionless mind. The function of the body would then be to provide the conditions for that event which is the arisal of finite individual egoistic consciousness. Without these conditions, ultimate mind remains as it is, the mysterious and unique fact of all existence. In that first moment when consciousness breaks into ideated being, the silence of mind has spoken. Not that it needed voice nor that it needed listener's carrot, but this is a mystery to be kept for a while in reserve. The tick-tock of time and the impressive landscape of the universe exist only mentally. This world which weighs so heavily upon us is but appearance, a shadow flung out of the timeless. Thus we arrive at the final conclusion that, not because things are outside our bodies, nor because they are very far from our bodies, nor because of their immense size, nor because of their great number, nor because of the varied elements which compose them, can we deny the mental nature of those things. The notion of the world is, in the final analysis, fabricated by the mind. It is a transitory mental construction. When we look out on a stretch of country scenery and observe a chain of hills far away with a small forest in the foreground, we do not dream for an instant that we are looking on a reconstructed scene. The hills are so high and so substantial, the trees are so green and so leafy, that we take these for solid things not in any way comparable with the pictures the mind constructs during daydreaming. But the science of psychology teaches that the entire landscape is as mind-made as the images that pass through consciousness during reverie. Every time a percept appears in the mind, it must necessarily be reconstructed anew, and therefore no one thing can have continuous existence nor appear twice in the same experience. What does appear is an incessant reconstruction of what is believed to be the same thing, and this is the real secret of the mystery of Maya, that celebrated but misunderstood Indian doctrine. In this way we learn the larger lesson of illusion, a lesson which is applicable not merely to our perception of solitary things but to our perception of the whole world. This vault of heaven under which we move, is like a magic lantern, this to prove, the sun there, is the flame, the world, the lamp, and we the figures who revolving move. O Markadam, you. But the solid objective world is not destroyed by mentalism. It is left precisely where it is. Its five continents are not denied, its impressive grandeur not banished. Only, for the first time, it begins to be understood instead of being misunderstood. The whole of your past is now a thought. The whole of your future is likewise a thought. The present is unsayizable and indeterminable, as was shown in an earlier chapter. Even if you could catch it, the past would at once claim it and it would be converted into an idea. Therefore all your life, which includes all its background of a panoramic world, is but a thought. If no other proof were available, this alone would suffice. Until you see that the world is only an idea, you are a materialist, no matter how pious, how religious, how spiritual you think you are. You take matter for what it is not. When you find that the material universe is just a mental experience, then alone do you become liberated from materialism. But the presence of ideas postulates the fundamental presence of mind, of that which makes us aware of ideas. Hence the materialistic picture of the world accounts for everything except the world itself. For it leaves out our conscious awareness of the world, which awareness is the only world we know. Any other world is merely an inferred one. Just as you cannot take the center out of a circle and still keep your circle, so you cannot take the mind out of the universe and still keep your matter. Both are indissolubly bound together. All materialistic theories are shipwrecked on this fatal fact. Whatever we examine in this world, mind is present at the very beginning, for the former exists only to consciousness. Moreover, mind is also the final entity. It cannot be kept out of any reckoning at any point. We are nearing the end of the first lap of our quest. We have brought the world down to the position of a great and grand appearance, but still a show. Every spectacle implies the existence of a spectator. What is this mystery that hides beneath the world show? It might be thought that the weak point in mentalism is its likelihood of leading to the position that the world is Oyi's own personal mental creation, a position which would be demonstrably absurd. For it would imply that we could capriciously form new stars at will merely by imagining them or construct whole cities by the voluntary exercise of fancy. Moreover, the latter existed before we appeared in the world and will probably continue after we are gone, whereas our imagined stars and cities will vanish in a few moments. The Himalaya mountains are still there to someone else, whether we, the downfall of materialism, think of them or not. Their existence is at least relatively more permanent, whereas our personal thought of them is transient. They are beyond the control of our own mind to make or unmake them. How then can mentalism make the bold fantastic assertion that the majestic Himalayas are merely ideas, merely mental states of feeble humans who cannot even create a single cedar tree by thought, let alone the world's mightiest mountain range? This criticism is quite just, but it embodies a complete misunderstanding. Whilst it must be rigidly maintained that every formed physical thing which exists must exist as a thought, we must not fall into the profound error which regards these thoughts as originating in the finite mind of a particular individual. They do not. They cannot. For this will lead to the further notion that there is no thing, no person, and no world other than one's individual self. Such is the erroneous conclusion which might be drawn from these statements. But such is not the finding of the hidden philosophy. The latter does not set up one's little limited self as alone real and all else as illusory. This error is technically termed solipsism. Solipsism is sheer lunacy. Were it true, this poor finite brain of ours would then become the creator and sustainer of the universe. Every object is an idea. It is an idea present to man's mind, but it is not created by man's individual and independent mind. He merely participates in it. For when we inquire more deeply, we shall find that his individual mind is ultimately part of a universal mind, and it is there that we must look for the origin of this idea. We dare not say that man himself creates the ideas of the material objects, but we can say that he has them. For an idea without a mind to which it belongs is inconceivable. The myriad manifestations of mind stand in striking contrast with the perfect and primary unity of the mind itself. The multitude of individual things that are really dash ideas must ultimately be ideas of an all-comprehensive mind. We must penetrate beneath the individual mind and lo, there is a universal mind as its hidden reality and as the origin of his ideas of material objects. Mentalism does not claim the world to be any individual's creation. It claims that the world is this mind's creation, not my mind's creation. It does not teach that the world is a product of one's individual mind, of one's personal self. Common experience is alone sufficient to invalidate such a tenet. It cannot possibly be held by any philosopher who has investigated the nature of mind and self, an investigation which will be made at the proper point in the second volume of this work. where the higher mysteries of mind will be unfolded. At this point we may again take up the two loose ends of yoga and philosophy and tie them together. For when the mind is better understood, then the proper place of mysticism and the extraordinary practices of yoga will likewise be better understood. It is much easier for one who has pursued such practices to grasp the truth of mentalism. He has already felt the world's unreality, but those who have never practiced find it difficult at first to credit mentalism. How, they say, can this solid tangible world be only an idea? Nonsense. The hardness of matter deceives them. But it is more easy for the yogi to convert this hard matter into imagination and thus the whole world into a thought. Yoga was partly devised as a means of preparing the mind to accept the teaching of mentalism. For when the mind has become subtle, detached and concentrated by the practice of a yoga system, it can more readily grasp this difficult doctrine with conviction. The power which is developed by such practice to abstract attention from physical surroundings and focus it upon internal states or ideas proves its value as an accessory to philosophy by rendering the truth of mentalism less hard to accept. The mind that has never practiced meditation or never engaged in the labors of artistic creation inevitably stumbles at the very threshold of this grand doctrine, whereas the flexibility and abstractiveness of the mind, which has previously disciplined itself to the point of easily attending to its own thoughts with complete concentration and complete forgetfulness of its material environment, assist it to walk across this threshold and perceive the heretofore hidden ideality of things. The universality of mind and the implication of mentalism also make it possible for us of the West to begin to understand how strange faculties whose existence has long been known to hoary Asia may operate in perfect obedience to scientific laws, how telepathy, apparitions, thought reading and thought transference, mesmeric feats and all the marvel magic and miracle of primitive and medieval religious, mystical and yogic history may be factually based, and how the little understood energy of Kaja may be as universally and ceaselessly present as the equally mysterious energy of electricity and be just as precise in its workings and effects. We have reached the position that the world is an idea, but we have reached it through acute analysis of experience and with minds sharpened by concentrated reflection on ascertainable and verifiable facts. The yogi who succeeds in his practices of meditation reaches the same position, but he has reached it by reverie or trance based on subtle feeling. But feeling is not a valid standard for others. The downfall of materialism, his conclusion is purely personal and therefore not of much value to them. When he is plunged in his meditation, he has a vivid sense of the dreamlike character of the world, how like a great thought it really is. But he can go no farther. He cannot penetrate to the reality which so expresses itself. So he contents himself with the illusion of his own spiritual reality, by which he really means mental, which the standpoint of regarding the world as a dream gives him. Henceforth he becomes temperamentally detached from the world, whose practical activities he comes to regard as a vain useless pursuit. Thus the highest effect of successful yoga, apart from intermittent tranquility, is to make man see the world as he would see a dream object and to feel acutely that the everyday experiences of ordinary existence suffer from unreality. Hence the mystic's attachment for escapism, his dislike of useful activity and fear of the practical world. But this is to stop halfway on the quest. It is certainly not the goal of philosophy. For the highest effect of philosophy is to make man feel the forms of this world to be dreamlike, but to know it as real in a higher sense, its essence being nothing less than reality itself. Again, just as the mystic receives the illusion of penetrating reality, so he also receives the further illusion of giving up his ego. This happens during meditation, and therefore intermittently, or more enduringly in the outer world through the development of martyr complex or through the practice of external non-resistance to evil. The philosopher, on the other hand, first loses the sense of reality of ego through insight into its relation to the whole and then gives it up in the outer world through service to mankind. Hence the true sage is keen on constant action because he is keen on real service. Yoga is a step, not a stop. When we are wiser, we shall ascribe to it the significance of being a most important milestone on our road, but still a milestone. Its delight should not be permitted to deceive us. There is still much more of the road to be traveled.